Welcome to the Second Society Project. My name is Dave Schmidt, and I'm visiting with Joe Atwell. Hello, Joe.
How are you?
Good. We had an interesting video released this week from the an online show called Dark Horse, which is the product of Brett Weinstein, a former biology teacher at Evergreen State College, and he has struck out on a new career after the brouhaha at his college, where primarily black students had declared it to be no white day, and he wound up appearing on campus to have classes. And so he has a new life. And in this particular show, he has two guests, one a virologist by the name of Maloney, and the other a former or current, I'm sure, Silicon Valley entrepreneur by the name Kirsch. Steve Kirsch, and the other one was Robert Maloney. If I need to correct any of those, I'll put it into the show notes.
Sure.
I plan on trying to capture that in an archive, because I fear that particular video may disappear. So after the show, I'll try to capture that. And it's quite interesting, this little meeting of these three men discuss some topics that we've been discussing. And you sent me it, and I think we both were excited about it. Well, how about if I let you comment on,
sure,
on what you thought were the salient points there?
Well, I mean, as you said, it was interesting to hear our subject matter and conclusions, to some extent, repeated by these guys, because they are,
first of all, Maloney's background is the individual who discovered the mRNA technology. So that's how he is introduced, as by having this. So just in general, you have someone who's very, very expert, or can be seen as such, in mRNA technology, because he is the individual who invented it. So the structure of the show was interesting in that it had could be seen by the public, they would see these guys are completely authoritative. And the story they brought them was the same one that we had been talking about for so many months, that the gene therapy vaccine was not adequately tested, and in fact could be either a bioweapon or something that is just extremely destructive to people's health. And so they talked about the increase in the adverse events. They talked about, which are spectacular, like 20 times anything that we've been looking at for other vaccines.
I would say even much more than that, Joe. I think
probably more. Yeah. Anyway, so it's just incredible how many more injuries are occurring being associated with this particular vaccine. They talked about the lack of, time that you need typically to produce a vaccine, which you and I would know would be 13 years on average, and only 2% are approved. So somehow these were able to get through in less than a year with 100% success rate. So this is very suspicious. But anyway,
that went part of Operation Warp Speed.
Yeah, Operation Warp Speed. Anyway, so then, but then they talked about the data. And I thought that, I think you'd agree with me, that was the most interesting part. They talked about the biodistribution study that you and I had discussed several weeks ago. And they were concurring with our concerns about it. They said that the study seemed to indicate that the injection, the what's called the vaccine, was not doing what it claimed to be doing in its specification sheet. And specifically, it did not stay in the shoulder area. It traveled throughout the body.
and that the spike protein separated. You had this free traveling genetically modified organism that was not staying in the area that it was supposed to, but it was traveling through the body.
Well, it had genetically modified molecule.
Yeah, right. Or exactly. It's a molecule. Exactly. Excuse me. And so now they said that it was accumulating in these areas, and the biodistribution chart gave the areas that it was accumulating, which were the ovaries and the bone marrow. Now, this is horrific because it will have impact upon, well, long-term autoimmune disorders can occur, but moreover, it may be functioning just as a very overt birth control and a permanent one, wherein they may be damaging the ovaries to the extent that they're not going to be able to produce children. So these are, no longer are we in sort of, you know, like our world where we're forced to speculate because of we don't, you know, have access to all the information. One of them, Maloney, was talking about data that he is aware of that it already exists at the CDC, which are confirming exactly what we've been talking about. So anyway, I just feel that people should listen to that that discussion, because it they'll pick up some good information. And I also think that I was asked by one gentleman. He was telling me how much trouble he was having keeping his daughter from taking the vaccine because of the social pressure, that there were parties she couldn't attend and things like this. And I sent this video to him with the idea that this would just give him a very nice summation of what his daughter need to be concerned about and why it was worthwhile. You know, in other words, if taking the vaccine was merely, you know, a discomfort or short-term effects, well, you might be able to say, okay, we don't want to miss the parties, you know, they're important socially, so we're going to take the vax. After seeing this stuff, the information these guys were talking about, which were underscoring so completely the stuff we've been concerned about, I just think that you have a really good sort of explanation for anyone as to why you can't take the vaccine. There isn't enough information about it. And I also think it's extremely suspicious, and they didn't get into it. Well, you and I are more into this set of information, is they didn't really talk about the motivation behind producing something that is so obviously flawed medically. They gave some kind of, well, it could be the system is choked with greed. You know, there was all these different sort of they weren't explanations. They were just rationales. But I think you have to look at evil. I think you have to look at population reduction. I think that you really, what you're seeing here is an attempt to bring about the conditions described in the Georgia Guidestones. So I thought that there's good information in this video, and it certainly would underline the fact that we've been on the right path all along trying to bring this information to the public.
Right. And I thought it was interesting that Steve Kirsch, when they discussed the possibility of how this came about and just slightly grazed the topic of whether there could be some sort of intent or deep culpable foreknowledge,
yep,
that many of these things were likely, he wanted to go in the direction of entertaining the possibility that there were, in his words, people in a room.
Yes.
Deciding. And Brett Weinstein seemed to be very taken with what he thought was an insight into the the explanation that, you know, when you create these large bureaucratic systems, you give it a charge to do something, you sort of corrupt it with all these public-private partnerships and what they were calling regulatory capture, which is, as people in the audience may realize, is where industry manages to essentially dominate the regulators with the possibility of going back and forth through the revolving door, or winding up with a very lucrative position, as is happening, by the way. Just last week, somebody from the FDA went into, I think it was Pfizer. So, and then also you supercharge it with billions of dollars, and you give it this, and then you also use the stick, which is the president declaring, that would have been President Trump and President Biden continuing it, this Operation Warp Speed, where people in the regulatory agencies, what that translates into is people in the regulatory agencies know that they're going to be fired unless they get with the program, of essentially rubber stamping these technologies. And that's what they are. We're still in the emergency use authorization phase. These are not licensed. These are not approved pharmaceutical devices. You and I are following into the trap, which we were avoiding for a while in our early podcasts. These are not, strictly speaking, vaccines. Let's put it this way. This mRNA technology has provided scientists with a tool for introducing the blueprint, if you will, for making aberrant, abnormal, or normal proteins into the cell. The proteins made out of amino acids. Proteins are long chains of amino acids, and the proteins really are the framework of the body. They also make a lot of the signaling molecules, like, for instance, insulin, a hormone, is a protein, and proteins also make the contractile elements in muscles, etc. And so when you alter the capacity of the cell to make proteins, you really have the business end of the cell in your grip. And so what these devices are little handy little devices for introducing new functions into the body, not only therapeutic function. I'll tell you how I approach it. About 20 years ago, I had some ideas about what could be done in the brain, specifically using signaling molecules called neuropeptides, and the neuropeptide process of binding to particular protein receptors. My interest was in the third ventricle of the brain, where there is an accumulation of cerebral spinal fluid passing through that space. And my ultimate goal was, if there were abnormalities in the receptors, that these neuropeptides would bind to, or abnormalities in the protein, in the polypeptides, which are short chains of amino acids, up to about 100 amino acids, not really fully a protein, but certainly simply just differing in size of amino acid chains with the protein. If there were abnormalities on either end there of signal or receptor, those could be altered and corrected. And particularly I was interested in the possibility for control of emotions or the process by which emotions are regulated. And there's also other things that are occurring in the third ventricle. So this idea is not something foreign to me. It's something I've considered myself. And you see, so the idea of doing this is not something new. You could say that with the advent of the harnessing of genetic technology, which was occurring in the early 1970s, the real beginnings of that. Of course, the DNA was its structure, and its role in genetics was reported famously by Watson and Crick in the 1950s. So this is all very, very recent stuff, but what we're talking about was immediately recognized by these people decades ago, really 70 years ago, and if not longer. I mean, even before we knew what the actual structures were, people were dreaming about figuring out what those structures were so that we could alter them. So there's always there's two sides, right? There's a kind of a purist scientist. That's how I, came on to it. It was all just interesting to figure out how things work, period. And then there is an element in human beings, and frequently scientists are pressured into this, and that is, the technology aspect. So there's science and then there's technology. Science is knowing something just to know it. That's the root of the word science, is to know. And technology, coming from techne in the Greek, is an idea of using some art to manipulate things into something useful, a tool. And, when you do that, you're always on the edge of that Faustian temptation and to make something dangerous. And there was somebody that reported that they were asking fellow scientists, would you do such and such if you knew that it would destroy human beings? Would you still do it? And many of them said yes. So you have to realize there is, especially when we go from science to technology, that the technological impulse is almost impossible to resist. Okay, so getting back to mRNA. The mRNA, for those of you that remember your high school algebra, remember that little notation of F parentheses X parentheses, F of X. And the idea that's conveyed there is that you have some little device, some little machine, if you will, in mathematical symbolism, it's F of X, the F part, which stands for function. So there's some machine and it has a function. And you can plug into it anything you want. You can plug in X, you can plug in Y, you can plug in any particular value for X or Y or Z. You could have F of 2.1 or F of 32 meters per second. Whatever it is that your function is supposed to spit out after you've plunked something in, that's how it works. Or the other way to think of it is a meat grinder. You know, you put something in one end, you turn the handle and that's the function. And the function of the meat grinder is to turn solid meat into ground up meat, and that's what comes out the other end. So what you have with the mRNA, I call it a nucleic acid pharmaceutical platform. And one instantiation of it is to put in a fragment of mRNA that will make a fragment of a potential antigen, in this case the spike protein, which is hoped to stimulate the subject's immune system to make antibodies. But that's just the lost leader. That's just the temptation gift, the giveaway that is being used, I believe, to entice the public into accepting this technology as a means of introducing just a wide variety, an unimagined, they haven't even imagined what all they can introduce yet. You don't have to, but they know in general that they can be introducing modifying things. So the mRNA device, the encapsulation with the polyethylene glycol, the fragment of mRNA, that is a tool, a device, a function into which they can plug anything they want.
Sure.
And to continue that idea, then we really need, and you and I have talked about this for months, we need to find a way to make the public more informed and educated about this. Why is it that Joe Atwell and David Schmitz, why is it that we are made anxious by this? And why is the public, so many in the public, good bit of the public actually is anxious about it, but many people, and in my experience, it's two groups. It's older people who've bought into this, and we can come up with reasons for that. You know, they were born or maybe even during World War II, and the 1950s and 60s, early 60s, before Vietnam War, were periods of great trust in the government, and especially before the assassination of John F. Kennedy, the president of the United States. So this was, but those were such wonderful years, just after World War II, so late 40s, early in the 1950s, the troops came home. They had their honeys waiting for them. They had nice large families. They built up suburban homes around the country, around the major cities. And there were plenty of jobs converting manufacturing of tanks and trucks and bombs back into making refrigerators and televisions. And so it's very hard for that generation of people and their children, who they so impressed with this imagery, it's so hard for them to think that the government would do anything bad. Because remember, they were taught to be suspicious of anybody suspicious about the government, because those people were probably enemy infiltrators. So we have that with that generation, and then with the young generation, unfortunately, and this is why it's hard to reach them, is that they have been so, I would say, criminally miseducated. I worked as a teacher. I taught just a little bit of high school for 1 year, but primarily I taught college. And I was just appalled back then at what was occurring in the academy. And so it's hard to reach somebody who's not been given the tools to hear. You have to have ears to hear a famous scriptural passage. Or to put it into a concept that we've been talking about, you have to have the receptor to which a signal can bind. If you don't have receptor signal binding, as in the case of a molecular receptor for a particular neuropeptide or hormone or other type of signal molecule, that there's no way to form that communication event. Or to put it in electronic terms, if you have a radio, you need to have a tuner which is somehow set to resonate with the frequency of the signal that you want to receive. If that match is not there, the communication is not occurring. And so you and I, we're trying to, I mean, we have such an enormous task because on the one hand, people need to learn the terminology. And I salute you for how you've jumped into this from the world of being in the business of computing and computer programming and making software. You absorbed the critical language and are able to even think creatively using that language. So there's that hurdle that has to be overcome. The other hurdle that has to be overcome is exercising the ability to use one's perceptual faculties, one's ability to detect patterns in complex presentations of sensory information that's coming at you through your eyes and your ears. You have to start organizing that into things that have meaning for the brain to process. And, you know, you can look at something, you see it in its simple characteristics. It's red, it's round, it sounds like a car horn, it sounds like a barking dog. And then to put it into larger stories. So you have to be able to narrate a story using those elements and the characters in a play and the set of the play to then create some type of a story, the plot. You have to provide a plot. And so, you see, this is just the natural processing of information. Now, I mentioned the assassination of JFK in 1963. By the late 60s, I think it was either 67 or 69, the CIA formulated and circulated among its offices a memorandum. I'll put I'll try to remember to put the number of the memorandum into our show notes. This memorandum essentially laid out a strategy for manipulating the perceptual abilities of the public. And the strategy involved the CIA operatives through a project we now know was called Operation Mockingbird, where they captured the television and the print news media. So this memorandum was one of the ways it really would operate was in disseminating throughout these news media and even into Hollywood, which they also had captured, the idea or the notion of conspiracy theory. And conspiracy theory used in a particular particularly corrupted way so as to disparage, to minimize, cause to be dismissed the activity of asking questions about the plot that we're seeing. So, people were very, from the get-go, people were suspicious about the assassination of John F. Kennedy. There were just too many things that were not fitting the government narrative, that just were not plausible. And to this day, a majority of people do not believe that Lee Harvey Oswald was either the lone gunman or was the gunman at all. And so the CIA had to promulgate this technique of smearing anyone who raises questions as being a conspiracy theorist, something to be avoided. Whereas, I mean, the truth of the matter, when you look at just that phrase of conspiracy theory, well, I mean, theorizing is what we're all doing when we are creating a narrative, when we're writing a play about how either nature or human beings work. So scientists dealing with nature or people police detectives or historians or I don't know that there are any around anymore, but journalists and other types. I mean, actually just about any human being, but those professions in particular, it's their job to create narratives and plots and try to ask questions about what's going on. And you and I have had discussions about how you do this well and how you learn to reject ideas that don't work. So I'm sorry, I'm going on long-winded here.
Yeah, but it's an important philosophy. It should be, you should go, particularly right now as we're transitioning from sort of a speculation into a more structured
data field.
Yeah, and I think that, so that's why it's really a good idea to sort of get people listening to us to understand where we are in this process. And I think now that, we can connect our conversations into specific affirmations of our assertions and our conjectures by experts using data, that we're in a different mode now. We can really start, in my opinion, to demand more from our listeners in terms of action, because right. There just isn't the vagueness any longer that could, permit ambivalence. I mean, we are really looking at what is becoming clearer and clearer, a process of genocide. And I just wanted to comment on the discussion that the experts had and the idea that this could have all come about accidentally, vis-a-vis regulatory capture by greedy people who really aren't trying to kill everyone. They're just trying to make money. I mean, that concept may be plausible.
In fact, it most certainly in its elements is at work. But what I think you and I are saying is it's not the only plot and a narrative. And there's another layer, another superimposed layer of an explanatory plot involved.
Right. Well, I wanted to point out one criticism of their thinking and their explanation, which is that none of them brought up the idea that the COVID pandemic itself was artificial, that you're looking at a statistical pandemic
not right. a real one. Now, if they had done that, they would see that the only explanation for the entire process, if you start
right.
the assertion that the COVID pandemic itself is artificial, is that you're dealing with a what they refer to as a group in a room deciding to go forward with all of this, that none of this is circumstantial. So I just wanted to point out that they really should have, because particularly Kurtz had gotten, he'd brought up the idea of evil people in a room as a possibility. They should have done a sweep, a panorama to see if they could create a story, as you had been talking about, a logical story that covered everything. And I think if you accept the fact, which you and I have discussed many times as a possibility, that we have a pandemic that has really a lot of artificiality and statistical hallucination and evil in back of it, now you have only one real explanation. You can't go to the idea of regulatory capture because that doesn't really cover the idea of a fake pandemic as well. What you have, Dave, is the last and best explanation is that we are dealing with a group, they are organized, and they are trying to kill us.
And for the listener who's just jumped in to this type of discussion, what Joe and I are pointing at are things like Event 201, which took place in October of 2019. I believe it's still online. You can find it. And Event 201 was organized through the largesse of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, as well as other entities, and it was organized by people at John Hopkins University. They seem to appear frequently in these type of things. And Event 201 was what people call a tabletopping event. It's like where military planners sit around and imagine, you know, how they want to invade another country with little toy tanks on the table. And if you look this up, simply look this up, Event 201, and you will find that these people foresaw all of this before, supposedly, there was this discovery of the SARS, what's come to be called the SARS SARS coronavirus, COV-2 virus. So, and then there are documents that precede this. I recommend for people that want an education in this area to listen to the Corbett Report, produced by James Corbett, Corbett. And he has plenty of history there. There's also a site, Tragedy and Hope, that you can look to get some background. There are documents preceding even Event 201, documents produced by the, Rockefeller, Foundation and others. So, these are all the elements that one has to use. And look, if you aren't forming a plot, if you aren't forming a narrative, if you aren't creating a theory about a conspiracy, you need to. You're just not being an adult. You're not being a citizen. So don't let them browbeat you into being some sort of just a prol or
a thought puppet.
Subhuman, a thought puppet. Yes, good one. Where you just repeat You just repeat like a parrot whatever flows out of that sewer pipe called television. So quit doing that, for God's sakes. If there's anything that people should be made ashamed of, it is to just plugging into the television output as though you were a mindless machine who simply translates that signal into, you're just a repeater of if there's anything that should be made onerous and disgusting in social and civil service circles is somebody who simply does that. And they're easy to recognize. They are easy to recognize. Anytime there's some event, you hear the same talking points coming from your family or your friends or your coworkers, your neighbors. When you hear these same talking points, just simply repeated uncritically and without analysis, without skepticism, then you know you're dealing with somebody who is a repeater, and you should challenge them on it. Just like they've been taught to call you a conspiracy theorist, you need to call them a mindless thought puppet repeater.
Yeah, absolutely. So I have sent out the video of the meeting to people that I am in communication with who are struggling with their family members who want to take the vaccine because of its advantages socially, going to parties or traveling, but are unaware of the possible consequences of taking it. One of the lines that I think was valuable in the discussion that they were referring to was Kirsch's, that you can't unvaccinate yourself.
Right. I mean,
this is a absolutely permanent decision. And since all of the information concerning this vaccine, this gene therapy, is not in, yet, you really are not in a position to make an informed consent to taking it, because you just don't know what the possible long-term effects can be.
And frankly, Joe, I don't even want to hold out for people the possibility that there can be anything good that comes from this. So it's not a question of, well, let's look at this for another 6 months and then we'll see. No. I mean, we have, we had a priori reasons for rejecting this. And, you know, last fall, you and I started this podcast series, these particular interviews, to focus in on the COVID scam and the vaccines. And we did that, and this is important for the listeners to know. There are two ways of approaching these type of unknown situations. One is based on rationality, rationalism, and the other approach is empiricism, where you collect data, you do scientific experiments, you do measurements, and then you count and you measure, and you have data. Both of them are important things to do. I've been a scientist. I love measuring things and collecting data. But I also, unlike many of my fellow scientists, I really am attracted to the rational approach, and that is just by looking at current knowledge and using reason. Oftentimes, you can come up with the answer even before you do the experiments. In other words, you do thought experiments. And this is called a priori reasoning. It literally means prior to experimentation. And so I, as somebody who has been in a role of teaching people science, I claim that you need to put both of those together well. And this is not just some philosophical rambling. Well, it is philosophical rambling, but you know, sometimes people use the word philosophy or theory in a disparaging way, and that's something we got to get people over overdoing that, because these are vital ways. If we had been doing that properly, we wouldn't be in the situation we're in. And so, for instance, where it's really relevant is early in this crisis, there was a physician in the New York City area by the name of Zev Zelenko. And he served primarily a large, if not exclusively, a large Jewish area or neighborhoods in the New York area. And Zev Zelenko, it's interesting, he cured himself of a lung cancer. I think it was, gosh, what was it? I think it might have even been melanoma. Mesothelioma. anyway, this guy was sharp, and he used a method which is really available to every physician in the United States. I don't know about in Canada, because those guys have been tightly absorbed into a government system of medicine. Same thing in England. And that's what's happening in the United States, not first through the government, but starting, what, maybe in the 1970s, really, with some speed. They've been corporatized. So I think it's something like 40% or more of American physicians now work for a corporation, their employees. And that whole thrust of that is to turn them into technicians who simply read instructions and prescribe. Well, Zev Zelenko, given this situation, he went outside of those constraints, which physicians are allowed to do. They're allowed to use drugs in what are called off-label uses. And he did. I mean, so we were presented with COVID, what was called COVID. It seems as though I'm of the opinion that there's something there that exists. I do believe that there's a virus, and that it's a virus that has been altered. And so that part I don't think is a figment in people's imagination. Now, where you and I certainly agree is that they only needed a little bit of this virus in order to create a fake story about a pandemic. And we should come back to that, how they did that, because that's important for people to realize the fakery involved in this, the phony pandemic idea. There's no pandemic out there. But Zev Zelenko, he was faced with people who seemed to be sick. I mean, if we accept this part of the story, and, he did some studying, and he came up with a mixture. I'm sure he altered it at stages. But he came up with a mixture that involved things like hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin. Myself, I used ivermectin prophylactically, and I never had COVID. I did have what I thought was the beginning of a viral gastrointestinal infection that was bothering me for about 3 days, and in the middle of the night I decided, well, if it's a virus, maybe it's one of the viruses whose mechanism of pathology is addressed by the ivermectin treatment, which so I tried it, and I'll tell you, I think I experienced almost immediate relief even before I fell back to sleep. And when I woke in the morning, I was fine. So anyway, that's just a little side note. I predict that ivermectin is going to find a place, a wider use. And in other countries other than the United States, you can buy ivermectin off the shelf in the pharmacy.
Yeah, it's incredible, isn't it? You know, you just don't have any issue at all getting it, but not here.
Right. So, okay, so I'm going to let me just finish this thing up about Zelenko, and then turn it over to you to add your thoughts to it or reaction. Zelenko used he focused on the early stage of the scientific method. You know, many of us have been in some sort of course in high school or college or beyond where we learn about the details of how you do the scientific method. And my complaint with the textbook summaries of these is that they often begin at one stage too late. They assume that you already have the hypothesis and then how to test that hypothesis. They don't give you much discussion about the formation of that hypothesis. And I think that's because that formation of that the hypothesis is an act of creativity. And a lot of these people in science and technology and engineering, they recognize that creativity exists, but they're kind of embarrassed about it. They're embarrassed about it because they can't quite describe how it happens. Many of them will assume that there's some material mechanistic explanation for how the brain does it. I think I'm of the opinion that we have to open the angle on our camera there and consider that there are some unexplainable, non-mechanistic aspects of the human mind that are never going to be able to be corralled by the technologists or the scientists in how these things come about. So, okay, so you see the world, you see all these swirling, moving images and sounds and tastes and feel. And then you put that all together somehow. It's like it you know, for as somebody, and I'm sure in your work, you've just come up with these ideas. Bang, wow, there it is. It all fits. I frequently wake up in the middle of the night, and it's as though in the dreaming state, freed up of other kinds of constraints or pressures or biasing factors, my brain seems to get put together some story. And so there is this creativity phase, and I think Zelenko did a great job in doing that. And this came out in the video that you and I are talking of a discussion between these three fellows on this Dark Horse product. They were talking about how in former days physicians felt freer to form these creative ideas about what's going on. They did house calls. They could see the environment that the patient was living in. They had a fuller picture of the human being. Anyone who's been to a doctor recently knows that you go in, he or she's sitting oftentimes by a computer terminal on a stand. They don't even get near you anymore. They don't want to touch you. They don't. You know, I don't know. These are like people who were taken off of Wall Street and then given a medical degree. They don't want to touch anyone icky, you know. And then they just ask you they look at your lab reports and ask you about what drugs you're taking, because that's what it's been reduced to. There's a lot there. I'm going to let you.
Go ahead, Jeff. Sorry, Jeff.
No, go ahead.
Well, I'm just going to say one of the reasons I don't go to doctors because I don't trust the chemicals, and that's all they're good for. They're just drug pushers at this point. I would use the AMA doctors in a mechanical sense, like to do sutures or, you know, like a knee replacement, but that's it. I don't want to even hear their opinions. I'm more interested in my own research than theirs. And also in my communications with people like you, we can just form better ways to deal with illness. I'll give you an example. I had bronchitis last month, didn't have a clear path out of it because I'd been having it for a couple of weeks. I kept waiting for my immune system to take over. But you pointed out that with bronchitis, oftentimes the bacteria are covered with coating materials, and it's hard for the – that's one of the reasons why it lingers. And you suggested I use a nebulizer, which I did, and I knocked it out in 2 days with, my own nebulizer treatment and hydrogen peroxide mist. I mean, literally, like you talked about ivermectin, you know, the quick response you got. 2 days after I started the treatment, bronchitis that had been lasting for weeks was disappeared. So this is also an example of the Socratic method, which I think needs to replace the thought puppet, kind of world of intellectual domination that we're all subjected to by the people who own the computers, the internet, so all of the place we get information from. We need to go back to challenging everything and exchanging information among ourselves. And that's one of the reasons why I always recommend, the Second Society podcast we do, because it's a really good place to start that process. And I also recommend people pay close attention to the discussion that is online. I think you can probably put a link to it, of the three guys who were, you know, with Weinstein, Malone, and Kurtz, because their discussion really took the concern and the clarity that we're dealing with something evil. The individual who developed the mRNA technology, Malone, in fact, he was very, very critical of the acceptance and distributing of the vaccine. And I just think because of his kind of credibility having developed this, this is a good person for all of our listeners to have sort of in their hip pocket. Whenever they're challenged by people saying, well, you're not following the science, you just say, no, you are not following the science. You are a thought puppet. You're succumbing to propaganda, which is not science. Look at this interview. Look at the individual who developed the technology. Look how he takes apart what we've been given as science. But because we were not in a position of criticism of it, we succumbed to it, became thought puppets. We are now watching the adverse events go through the roof. And if you listen to these guys and they talk about the potential for downstream, in other words, what we're seeing now, everyone knows now anecdotal experiences of people getting sick from the vaccine. I mean, this is just now all virtually ubiquitous. But when you listen to these guys talk and they're underlying what Dave had been talking about months ago, that the real threat here is downstream. You get into autoimmune, which can take years to develop. You get into different kinds of cancer, which can come out of the bone marrow, again, can take years to develop. We could be looking at a true apocalypse of the human race here. And, of course, look at the birth control aspect of it because of the spike proteins concentration in the ovary. Anyway,
and that's an area that I was hoping that Brett Weinstein, who taught these classes in ecology and evolutionary biology at Evergreen State, I thought he would. I was hoping he would develop this more because remember we were talking about how when you make these changes to the sex cells, these are irreversible changes.
Yeah.
The genetic code, the code of what makes you who you are. I was interviewed by Brian McCall, a law professor who edits Catholic Family News. And we did a whole interview on the idea that accepting this vaccine is really a process of self-mutilation. So in moral theology, to mutilate yourself in any way for non-therapeutic reasons is it's considered sinful. It's a sinful act. So in other words, you can amputate a limb or you can extirpate an organ that has become diseased, and in that action it hopefully restores one to health. Any other type of action, surgical action or permanent alteration of the body, or even a temporary abuse of the body, is prohibited in moral terms. It's sinful. It's not a word that you typically hear in a discussion about medicine or science. But we're given a clue about what is sinful about it. I'm not resorting to a consequentialist analysis of theology here, or ethics, because I'm not fundamentally a consequentialist in my ethical thinking, that doesn't mean that one doesn't have consequences involved in various kinds of sinful actions. So what are we talking about here in this case? Well, by tinkering around and altering, which in many cases just is blind alteration of genetic material. And this stuff we do know, you and I have talked about it in a previous podcast, it didn't come up really other than to be dismissed, as I recall, in this interview on the Dark Horse. But other researchers at MIT and elsewhere, researchers like Luc Montagné, a virologist who received the Nobel Prize in, I think it was 2008, for his work on viruses, he is warning us that there is very likely going to be incorporation of reverse transcribed.
Yeah, that gets into that whole terrible possibility of really turning our bodies into a spike protein factory or some other thing. Dave, I have to go. This is unfortunately on this morning I have all sorts of duties within the household. I got to get started. I just want to thank you for this great discussion, and hopefully we can do it again real quick. All right.
Sounds great.
All right, buddy. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.